Welcome to today's reading of Sports Today, a one-hour reading of sports news from 7 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday and Thursday. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Some Sounds of Arizona. Let's begin with a reading from USA Today Sports Weekly that reads, Oregon Ducks impressed the committee so much that they got the short straw. This feature written by Dan Wolken, columnist for USA Today. Dear Oregon Ducks and head coach Dan Lanning, this is the College Football Playoff Selection Committee. Congratulations on a wonderful season and a hard-won conference championship in your first year as a Big Ten member. We are highly impressed with your 13-win, no-loss record, especially in a season where so many teams faltered along the way. And when we consider that you had to fly to the Eastern or Central time zone four times, finishing off a perfect season with a 45-37 win over fellow playoff participant Penn State last Saturday night, it is truly one of the great accomplishments of the last several years. In fact, we as a committee are so enamored with what you have done that we're going to award you the playoffs number one seed. Again, many congrats, Oregon. But here's the thing, Coach Lanning. In every other sport that decides championships in a tournament format, the best teams or individuals get seeded in the order that they are ranked to ensure that the bracket is balanced and fair. It doesn't always work out perfectly, but this is considered standard practice to give the highest-seeded teams the easiest theoretical path possible towards a championship. After all, that's what they have earned by virtue of their regular season accomplishments. If you thought that that was how it was going to go in college football, though, the joke's on you, Oregon. We don't do things like other sports, at least not until we are publicly shamed to a sufficient extent or dragged into court by antitrust lawyers. But never mind that. Here's the reality of your situation. Despite all the great things that you've done, you are not getting the easiest path as a reward for being the top team in the country. Far from it, in fact. What the committee has cooked up for you is a quarterfinal against either Ohio State, which might be the sport's most talented and expensive roster, or a Tennessee team that is currently ranked number 8 nationally in offense and number 4 on defense. In fact, if we were putting together the bracket strictly by our committee rankings, you would never see either of these teams unless it was in the championship game. Instead, you'd be playing the winner of Boise State, Indiana in the quarterfinals. Oops. Oh, but that's not all. If you are fortunate enough to survive that quarterfinal matchup on a neutral field, remember you only beat Ohio State 32-31 at home a couple of months ago, you're not going to get the winner of a favorable matchup between number 4 Penn State and number 5 Notre Dame in the semifinals. Rather, you're very likely just going to get a number 3 ranked Texas team that will be heavily favored to cruise over Clemson at home and then Arizona State in the quarterfinals. In other words, even though the Longhorns did not beat a top 25 team all season and went 0-2 against Georgia, we are giving them an easier path to the semifinals than the one that we are giving you. And that's kind of a theme in how we arranged this bracket. Georgia, the number 2 seed, gets the winner of Indiana-Notre Dame. Penn State, the team that you just beat for the Big Ten title, gets SMU and then Boise State. If we are getting real about you, Oregon, your first playoff game is probably going to have the smallest point spread of any quarterfinal. We wish we could say as a committee that we gave you this burden because we think you're a good enough team to handle it, but that wouldn't be the truth. It's because we are constrained by a nonsensical system that the conference commissioners came up with before they all decided to blow up their sport from coast to coast. When the 12-team playoff was conceived, the idea was that conference championships should be rewarded with a first-round bye, and so the 4 highest-ranked title game winners would slot in as numbers 1 through 4. But that was back when the conferences, although not perfectly even in strength, were similar enough that recognizing championships made sense. What happened subsequently, though, is that Oklahoma and Texas left the Big 12 for the SEC. Then Southern California and UCLA left the Pac-12 for the Big 10. Then the Pac-12 imploded, and we ended up with a bunch of 16-team leagues where it was impossible to have any scheduling balance, even within leagues. But because conference commissioners are inherently selfish and look out only for their best interests, not those of any sport at large, they could not agree on any adjustments to the 12-team format. As a result, we were forced to give Boise State the number 3 seed, despite ranking them number 9, and to give Arizona State the number 4 seed, despite ranking them number 12. We were also too lazy to make any significant adjustments to seeding based on the results of the conference championship games and boxed ourselves into some unfortunate situation because ESPN forces us to go on television every week, give fake rankings with incomplete data, and then try to explain them to the public. So at the end of the day, we recognize that the bracket is a nonsensical mess that puts you at a severe disadvantage. Here is how our chairman, Michigan Athletic Director Ward Manuel, explains it. Quote, "We rank the teams 1 through 25. That's what we've been asked to do," he said on ESPN. "We don't discuss if we put this team at number 1 and we move this team to number 8 or number 9 and that they're going to be playing each other and we need to go back and reconsider how we feel about them in the top 25. We have been asked as a committee to rank the best teams 1 through 25. Then the seeding and what the commissioners set up is how to seed those teams come into play, and we only can go off what they want us to do as we seed the teams in the tournament. It turns out that it's a very good game in terms of 8 through 9 and playing 1, but from the start, that's what it was going to be, and we don't know who those teams are until we go through the top 25, unquote. In other words, Oregon, we can only offer you a bunch of rhetorical gobbledygook that explains why our process stinks so badly. That's not just our problem, though. It's yours. So enjoy the playoff, and congratulations again on drawing the short straw. Sincerely, the College Football Playoff Selection Committee. And again, that feature is entitled Oregon Ducks impressed committee so much that they got the short straw, written by Dan Wolkin, columnist for USA Today. And in other college football news, this next feature is entitled SMU's Selection to the Playoff Might Save the ACC. And this feature, written by Matt Hayes, USA Today Sports Network. Look at the pitiful ACC. No shame at all. Celebrating Clemson and SMU in the college football playoff as a verifying and flag-planting moment for the conference on the verge of collapse. Clemson, the ACC champion and automatic qualifier, is suing the ACC to leave the league. SMU, the ACC's at-large CFP selection, paid $200 million to get into the ACC and was only allowed to join if it forfeited all media rights cash for 9 years. 9 years! That's right, SMU, which last Sunday afternoon raised the profile of a dying conference by securing a precious at-large CFP bid over SEC heavyweight Alabama. SMU is an unpaid intern for a decade. SMU, which just added untold millions to the ACC's coffers and will add more with every win in the playoff, is monetarily supplementing the other 15 teams in the league. This is about SMU legitimizing the ACC and saving the league from its own inevitable undoing of falling further behind the SEC and Big Ten because of a poor product on the field. You want college football like it used to be? Thank a billionaire. Thank one of the handful of SMU boosters that pulled together some pocket change to get the Mustangs into a power conference. Left for dead long ago with the dismantling of the old Southwest Conference, SMU reached out to the very people who earned them the NCAA's big haircut in the 1980s to save themselves from drifting further into college football irrelevance. Who could have known they'd take the ACC along with them in year one? It's a couple $100 million, SMU mega booster David Miller told Yahoo, quote, "I'm not losing sleep over it," unquote. Fat cat boosters are people too, everyone. But this is more than just another ACC team in the college football playoff. Because when the conference commissioners meet this offseason to discuss the format and financials of the new 2026 playoff contract, the Big Ten and SEC's ability to demand more from the ACC and Big 12, or else, has at least been slowed momentarily. The SEC will use Alabama's snub as an opportunity to declare it needs four or more automatic bids moving forward in a 14-team playoff. The Big Ten will do the same. The only pushback for the ACC, which could lose both Clemson and the original disruptor, Florida State, to legal action, is the statement made by SMU in year one as an ACC member. A conference on the rise, the ACC will argue. When everyone is playing on a level field in 2025 with the $20 million salary cap, watch how the gap between the have and have-nots shrinks. Miami was the second team out in this year's CFP, And if the projected 14-team format of 2026 were currently in play, the ACC would have three teams in the CFP. You want an all-at-large field, as SEC Commissioner Greg Stanky has floated? We'll take it. Why do I have a vision of Fredo slobbering over himself, demanding respect from Michael Corleone, knowing that it's a futile task? Quote, "I'm smart and I want respect," unquote. If the ACC presidents were proactive, they would use this power move by SMU as leverage against Florida State and Clemson. In other words, we had three teams in the top 14, and Florida State, the one school with the greatest upside in the conference, lost 10 games in a rare step back. This isn't rocket science. Come up with a revenue-sharing agreement that benefits the conference blue bloods and give your conference a fighting chance to stay relevant. If the rest of the conference doesn't like that Florida State, Clemson, Miami, and North Carolina are receiving more of the media rights pie, find a few sugar daddy boosters of your own and get better. Or you can be unpaid interns too in college football's rapidly changing environment and end up like Fredo. And again, that feature is entitled SMU's Selection to the Playoff Might Save the ACC, written by Matt Hayes, USA Today sports writer. And in other college football news, here's a short piece on games to watch this weekend in college football. Headline reads, "Army and Memphis can finish off strong years." This feature written by Eddie Tamanus of USA Today. One game this Saturday, number 18 Army, will be facing Navy in Landover, Maryland. This game is scheduled to begin at 1 p.m. Mountain Time on CBS. The 125th meeting in the most storied series in college football will officially conclude the regular season. Eight of the last 10 meetings have been one-score contests, including last year's 17-11 Army victory that ended in a goal-line stand. Add the fact that both academy squads are enjoying successful seasons, and the fact that this meeting will determine the outright winner of the Commander-in-Chief's Trophy, so it should be appointment viewing. The Black Knights of Army are fresh off winning the American Athletic Conference title in their first year in the league. Army quarterback Bryson Daly is having a tremendous season, entering this contest with over 1,400 rushing yards and 29 touchdowns, with an additional 877 yards passing with 8 scores. When he doesn't keep the ball, it most often ends up in the hands of running back Kanye Udo, Noah Short, or wide receiver Casey Reynolds. The Navy defense, of course, will be quite familiar with the Black Knights formations. Expect linebackers Colin Ramos and Kyle Jacob to be in the vicinity of the point of attack often. Navy starting quarterback Blake Horvath, injured early in the loss to Tulane, remains doubtful. Backup Braxton Woodson has taken plenty of meaningful snaps, and fullback Alex Texa and running back Eli Heidenreich can help keep the ball moving. The main stoppers along the Army front are linebackers Andon Thomas and Caleb Fortner. Prediction? We'll take the Black Knights to close out one of the best seasons that West Point has experienced in a long time. Army should win this one over Navy, 21-17. And another game to watch this Saturday, a salute to the Veterans Bowl in Montgomery, Alabama, where South Alabama will be taking on Western Michigan. The game is scheduled to start 7 p.m. on Saturday on ESPN. Western Michigan University needed a win in its regular season finale against Eastern Michigan to earn this bowl trip and should give a strong effort. The Jaguars' top weapon is wide receiver Jamal Pritchett, who has 91 catches for over 1,100 yards with 9 touchdowns and an additional score via punt return. Quarterback Gio Lopez also gets plenty of ground support, split almost evenly between running backs Fluff Bothwell and Kendrell Bullock, who will keep Western Michigan linebacker Donald Willis and safety Haylock busy. The Broncos' solid offensive line features center Jacob Gideon, a finalist for the Remington Trophy. His group paves the way for running back Jaden Nixon and provides protection for quarterback Hayden Wolf. They must beware of safety Jaden Voisin, who has 5 of the Jaguars' 15 interceptions this season. Prediction will give the nod to the Jaguars playing closer to home, so South Alabama should win this one 34-27 over Western Michigan. And one more college football game this weekend, the Frisco Bowl in Frisco, Texas. Number 23 Memphis will be taking on West Virginia. This game will be taking place on Tuesday, December the 17th at 7 p.m. Mountain Time on ESPN. The Tigers overcame an early setback against Navy to win 6 of their last 7 games, while the Mountaineers of West Virginia will be in the midst of a change in leadership following an uneven Big 12 campaign. Offensive coordinator Chad Scott will coach West Virginia in the bowl game following Neil Brown's dismissal. There will at least be a veteran hand at the controls in quarterback Garrett Green, though he'll want to forget his most recent outing quickly, in which an interception and lost fumble helped Texas Tech on its way to a 52-15 romp. Another high-octane offense awaits. Memphis puts up over 35 points per game, led by the accomplished triumvirate of quarterback Seth Hennigan, running back Mario Anderson Jr., and wide receiver Rock Taylor. Prediction? The Tigers of Memphis wrapped up their regular season with a convincing road win at Tulane, and now they'll have plenty of incentive to close out the year with a top 25 ranking. So Memphis should win this one over West Virginia 41-21. And from college football, let's turn to some NFL football and Week 14 winners and losers. Headline reads, "Ex-contender in free fall, while others sinking." This feature is written by Lorenzo Reyes of USA Today. NFL fans, rejoice. We are entering the final month of the regular season, and several key playoff races are heating up. Nothing is more contested than the AFC wildcard chase, where all 3 teams currently in position to claim those berths, the Baltimore Ravens, Los Angeles Chargers, and Denver Broncos, are sitting at 8 wins, 5 losses. In the NFC, it's the 8-win, 5-loss Washington Commanders who were on their bye week in Week 14 who should be most concerned. The Los Angeles Rams, at 7-6, trail them by one game and just picked up a massive victory against the 2 seed in the AFC, the Buffalo Bills. It all points to what should be a wild, thrilling end of the 2024 season. Here are the winners and losers from Week 14 in the NFL. Among the winners, the Rams, who are inconsistent, but when they play well, they can compete with anyone. Los Angeles earned a massive 44-42 win against the AFC's number 2 seed to climb into the number 8 seed, just one game back of the Commanders, who are in the final wild card slot. Matthew Stafford and Puka Nacua had a massive day, with Nacua hauling in 12 of 14 targets for 162 receiving yards and a score. Cooper Kupp was also essential with 92 yards and another touchdown. Both players helped the Rams convert nearly three-quarters of their third downs, 11 out of 15. LA's defense opted not to spy Josh Allen, allowing him to run free for 82 yards. Allen also threw for 342 yards and 3 scores. The difference is that the Rams offer more balance, whereas the Bills often need Allen to take on an unsustainable amount of responsibility. In any case, the Rams' season may just come down to their finale against the current NFC West leading Seattle Seahawks. Other winners would be the 49ers. The Niners dominate in a much-needed win, but it comes at a cost again. It feels like the 49ers cannot catch a break with their injuries. San Francisco snapped a 3-game losing streak and throttled the Chicago Bears, racing out to a 24-point lead in a 38-13 win. This was a game without running backs Christian McCaffrey and Jordan Mason, though Isaac Garendo flashed serious potential. Garendo had 17 touches for 128 yards from scrimmage and 2 touchdowns against Chicago before he was forced to exit. 49ers coach Kyle Shanahan said after the game the belief was that it was a foot sprain. San Francisco, who is now 6 wins, 7 losses, is in the 11th seed in the NFC and needs a ton of help to get into the playoffs. Edge rusher Nick Bosa and left tackle Trent Williams remained out. The 49ers, frankly, will need some good luck down the stretch, and they must win the rest of the way. Then there are the Miami Dolphins. The Dolphins save their season, but serious flaws need fixing. Miami, with its season on the brink, battled back late to force the New York Jets into overtime, where it dominated, scoring a first-drive touchdown to prevail 32-26. The Dolphins, however, have serious flaws that jeopardize their push down the stretch. The rushing game has been anemic over the last 3 games. It has gained just 49 yards per contest. Against the Jets, Devon Achane ran 14 times for only 24 yards. The next closest rusher was rookie Jalen Wright with 2 carries for 7 yards. The short yardage offense overall has been wholly ineffective, and the defense has been gashed over the last month. The Dolphins remain the number 9 seed in the AFC, 2 games back of the 7th-seeded Broncos. But complicating matters for Miami is its Week 7 loss against the Colts, who should hold the tiebreaker. There is simply no margin for error for the Dolphins. Then there are the Bucks of Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay, who's now 7 wins, 6 losses, has taken over first place in the NFC South on its 3-game winning streak, and it's the rushing offense that is controlling the games. Granted, the teams that the Bucks have beaten during this stretch, the Raiders, the Panthers, and the Giants, are 3 of the worst teams in the NFL at a combined record of 7 wins, 32 losses. But Tampa Bay has outrushed each of those teams by an average of 100 yards per game. That has allowed the Bucks to control the clock, set up favorable distances on third downs, and extend drives. Tampa Bay entered the day ranked 2nd in third down efficiency. The Bucks have signature wins this year against the Lions, being the lone team to beat Detroit this season, and a win against the Eagles. But another test looms next weekend against the Los Angeles Chargers. Then there are the losers in the NFL, fringe teams and pretenders in the AFC wildcard race. With the Los Angeles Chargers' loss against the Chiefs last Sunday night, it's very crowded at the bottom of the playoff picture in the AFC. 4 teams, including the AFC South leading Texans, are tied at 8 wins, 5 losses. That puts the 3 teams outside of the field, but currently alive for playoff contention, the Colts, the Dolphins, and the Bengals, in extremely tough spots. It also means that teams like the Ravens, who have an abundance of talent but massive holes, and the Broncos, who still have the Chiefs and the Chargers on their remaining schedule, cannot afford to stumble in the final month of the season. Even the Steelers, who are in a tough division but have the Chiefs, the Eagles, and the Ravens left on their schedule, should be cautious. The real winners are the fans, who will certainly enjoy what should be a wild ride to decide the wild card. Then there are the Falcons. The Atlanta Falcons' November nightmare continues into December. It's time to sound the alarm in Atlanta. The Falcons, who are now 6 wins, 7 losses, and losers of 4 consecutive games, are imploding. A month ago, after their Week 9 victory over the Cowboys, the Falcons were 6-3 and sitting in the 3rd seed in the NFC with a 2-game lead in the NFC South. Now, Atlanta has fallen out of the playoff picture altogether as the current number 9 seed and has given up the lead in the division, and quarterback Kirk Cousins is spiraling. During Atlanta's 4-game losing skid, Cousins has a touchdown-to-reception ratio of 0-8. Atlanta is also 4 of 13, or 30%, in red zone conversions over the last 4 games. Their defense, despite generating 9 sacks over the last 2 weeks, continues to blow coverages in the secondary, yielding huge plays. This is not winning football. And then there are the Arizona Cardinals. The Cardinals lose the season series against the Seahawks and are now in a significant hole. In the span of 3 weeks, the Cardinals, who are now 6 wins, 7 losses, lost twice to the Seahawks, putting their path to the playoffs in a precarious position. Arizona had been in first place ahead of its Week 12 showdown against Seattle. Now the Cardinals, with the Rams' victory over the Bills, find themselves in 3rd place in the NFC West, two games back of the division-leading Seahawks. Quarterback Kyler Murray combined to rush for just 25 yards across both meetings against Seattle. In both matchups against the Seahawks, Arizona combined to go 7 for 24 on third downs and 1 out of 5 in the red zone. The next two games of the schedule are favorable, but the Cardinals close with the Rams and the 49ers. And from football news, let's turn now to some baseball news. Headline reads, Soto bet on himself to get $765 million. And this feature written by Bob Nightingale, columnist for USA Today. Dateline, Dallas. Juan Soto made it quite clear that he was going to sign with the highest bidder when he became a free agent after the New York Yankees lost the World Series. He was a man of his word. Soto agreed to a staggering 15-year, $765 million contract last Sunday night with the New York Mets, shattering the record for the biggest contract in sports history. The Yankees, Boston Red Sox, and Toronto Blue Jays all made bids of at least $700 million, but the Mets came in with the highest, just $5 million more than the Yankees' 16-year, $760 million contract, a high-ranking Yankees executive told USA Today Sports. Yet while there was only a $5 million difference overall, the annual average salary of the Mets contract is $51 million compared to the Yankees' $47.5 million. The deal also does not include a penny of deferred money with a $75 million signing bonus, along with an opt-out after the fifth year. If the contract wasn't already big enough, it could be worth $805 million, a person with direct knowledge of the deal told USA Today Sports. The Mets have the right to void Soto's buyout if they increase his salary from $51 million to $55 million beginning in 2030 for 10 years. Soto's deal is more than $300 million richer than any contract in the history of baseball. Shohei Ohtani signed a 10-year, $700 million contract last year with the Los Angeles Dodgers, but with $780 million deferred, it lowered the present-day value to about $460 million. And just like that, Mets owner Steve Cohen, the richest owner in baseball with a net worth of about $21 billion, showed off his financial clout by refusing to be outbid. He also views it as a shrewd investment opportunity, not only helping the Mets escape the Yankees' shadow in New York, but providing a significant boost at the gates. The Mets suffered the largest attendance decline in the National League last season, drawing a quarter million fewer than in 2023, despite ultimately reaching the National League Championship Series. Now they'll believe that with Soto aboard, they'll gain a significant uptick in season ticket sales, hoping to draw 3 million fans for the first time since 2009. While Soto was informing the Mets that he was coming their way, the Washington Nationals front office was having dinner at the Anatole Hotel, remembering that 2.5 years ago they had offered Soto a 15-year, $440 million deferred contract. Soto's declining of the offer turned out to be the best financial investment since Tesla, and perhaps the Nationals' most prudent decision by trading him to San Diego in July of 2022, knowing that they could not afford to sign him to an extension. While the talk was always that Soto was seeking a $500 million contract and perhaps even broaching $600 million once Ohtani signed, no one could have imagined that he would hit $700 million with four teams still in the bidding, with the Mets adding $30 million to their last offer on Sunday. And again, that feature is entitled Soto Bet on Himself to Get $765 Million, written by Bob Nightingale, columnist for USA Today. And another baseball feature, also written by Bob Nightingale, headline reads, Dick Allen, Dave Parker named to the Baseball Hall of Fame, Dateline Dallas. They prayed, they held hands, and when they finally heard the news they've been awaiting for four decades, the Dick Allen family broke into tears, hugged one another tightly, and yelled, finally, finally. Dick Allen, who was on the ballot for the first time in 1983, was elected Sunday night into the Baseball Hall of Fame by the Classic Baseball Era Committee alongside longtime friend Dave Parker. It was like champagne popped, said his son Richard Allen Jr., age 59. I wanted to hear it. I wanted to see it. We saw it. Big sigh of relief. Really, there's a lifetime of emotion just pouring out. It was worth the wait. It just makes it that much more exciting. Long overdue, long overdue, unquote. The family with Allen Jr., his son Trey, and nephew Rick Allen, who sat together in a private room at the Anatole Hotel, received calls from Hall of Famer Goose Gossage, Philadelphia Phillies owner John Middleton, and friends and families throughout the country. Middleton, who's responsible for the Phillies retiring Allen's number 3 months before he died at the age of 78 in the year 2020, openly cried when he heard the news. I am still crying thinking about it, Middleton said. I just wish he was here to enjoy it, unquote. Yes, the shame is that Dick Allen won't be walking across the stage at the induction ceremony this summer. But the truth, Allen Jr. said, is that his dad would have wanted everyone to rejoice and regale in baseball's ultimate honor without him anyway. This is why the family planned to celebrate the Hall of Fame in a way that Allen would have wanted, throwing back some cold beers to celebrate. I'll be honest with you guys, Allen Jr. said. He always loved the green Heinekens. That's what we're getting. Ready to get some green ones, unquote. Allen laughed, knowing that if his father were alive, he would still rather talk about the horses than his 15-year professional baseball career, earning 7 All-Star berths, the 1964 Rookie of the Year Award with the Phillies, and the 1972 MVP Award with the Chicago White Sox. You know, he never wanted to talk about it, Allen Jr. said. He never did talk about it. He always thanked and felt other people were more deserving. I used to tell him, your numbers are just as good. You should be there. You should be there. And he's like, yeah, I'm all right. I'm all right. So how it happened, it was so good, unquote. Allen was on the Hall of Fame ballot 14 years and twice was on the contemporary era ballot, falling one vote short in 2014 and once again in the year 2021. Well, on this night, that heartbreak turned into euphoria when Hall of Fame President Josh Rawich began reading Allen's stats, with the family immediately knowing that they were about to officially announce Dick Allen. He received 13 votes from the 8-member committee, one more than necessary. They didn't even hear Rawich call out his name on the TV set, with the celebration reverberating in the Cardinal A room at the Anatole Hotel. "We did it! We did it! He made it! He got in!" unquote. And then there was Goose Gossage, who has been lobbying for Allen for years, calling him the most instrumental teammate of his career, on speakerphone yelling, "No freaking way!" If Allen were alive, his family said, they're not even sure that he would have shown any emotion. This is a man who would much rather talk about his love for horse racing than his baseball career. He's probably telling one of his old stories, his horse stories, Allen Jr. said, deflecting the honor, but appreciative of it at the same time. They actually had to mail him the MVP trophy because he didn't take it, so that is his humbleness. So for this, I think he is happier that I would be doing this and not him, unquote. If the evening could possibly be any sweeter, it was the news that Dave Parker, his longtime friend from the Pittsburgh Pirates, would be going into the Hall of Fame together. Allen Jr. still has a glove, Cobra 19, that Parker gave him as a kid. He still has a large photograph of the two together. Now, after battling deep-seated racism during their era, with Allen once wearing a baseball helmet playing first base because of objects thrown from the stands, they will be linked together forever in baseball immortality, a day that the Allen family began to doubt would ever happen. "I had kind of lost faith," Allen Jr. said. "I kind of thought that, you know, eventually he'd be forgotten, and the people that were not knowing him to watch him play, that they would be gone and his family's passed away," unquote. Now he'll be forever remembered, not for the iconic Sports Illustrated cover in which he was juggling baseballs while smoking a cigarette, but for being one of the greatest players to play the game. He was one of the premier power hitters of his generation, with 6 seasons of more than 30 homers and 6 seasons hitting at least 300. He had the highest slugging percentage and OPS of every player with at least 3,000 plate appearances from 1964 to 1974, with the exception of Hall of Famer Hank Aaron. Dave Parker was also one of the most feared hitters in his 19-year career. The 7-time All-Star won the 1978 MVP award, hitting .290 for his lifetime batting average, with 2,712 hits, 339 homers, and 1,493 RBIs. Quote, "I've been holding this speech in for 15 years, said Parker, who has been battling Parkinson's disease. "This has been a long time coming," unquote. Yes, indeed, for both of these sluggers. And again, this feature is entitled Dick Allen and Dave Parker Named to the Baseball Hall of Fame, written by Bob Nightingale, columnist for USA Today. And in other baseball news, this next headline reads, "Spurned Yankees and Soto losers forced to pivot." This feature written by Gabe Lackus of USA Today. For the losers in the Juan Soto Derby, all is not lost. Just one of the greatest free agents of all time and a generational left-handed hitter is all. Yet it's nothing that cannot necessarily be overcome now that Soto is a New York Met for the norm-shattering price of $765 million over 15 years. The Mets are guaranteed nothing save for a level of relevance possibly not seen since the 1980s and a cog in their lineup for the next decade and a half. So what do plans B, C, and D look like for the spurned finalists? Let's explore. Let's look at the Yankees. How does Batman replace Robin in the lineup? No need to sugarcoat it. This is devastating for the Yankees. Juan Soto and Aaron Judge made for one of the great middle-of-the-order duos in Major League history, combining for 99 home runs, joining with Giancarlo Stanton to reestablish a punishing Bronx Bombers presence and drive the Yankees to their first World Series since 2009. With Soto tossed around like high-end leftovers through three franchises the past 3 years, he wasn't going to miss his chance at calling his own shots, finally. And the Yankees knew the advantage of their 1 year of speed dating was only going to go so far. You get the sense that owner Hal Steinbrenner got the sense that there would be no way he would outbid Mets counterpart Steve Cohen, although adding a 16th year to the deal was a little bit pound foolish. Once you're playing in that stratosphere, why even bother thinking about the luxury tax? There are times to play the George Steinbrenner is dead card when analyzing Hal's maneuverings, but this probably is not one of them. Lest we forget, when George passed away in the year 2010, the Mets owner had recently lost close to $1 billion in a Ponzi scheme. Steve Cohen is not Fred Wilpon, and for all of the Steinbrenners' generational wealth, the game has changed when hedge fund kingpins like Cohen own a ball club. Cannot fault Hal too much for saying uncle when he was getting yanked down the Cohen's bottomless pit of cash. What now? The answers for the Yankees are all suboptimal to a degree. The Yankees can try to add power and address badly needed upgrades by pursuing Alex Bregman, Pete Alonso, or Christian Walker, with the first two options likely costing in excess of $200 million. All three are right-handed hitters, however, which would badly imbalance the lineup around Judge. That's where a trade for Cody Bellinger makes so much sense. They could likely import the lefty-hitting, athletically elite first baseman slash outfielder from the Cubs for not much more than taking on the potential $52 million owed Bellinger this year and next year. He has a player option for 2026. Bellinger-Bregman would be a dynamic combo and could nudge Judge back to an outfield corner. It also would not hamstring the Yankees with too many dudes on long contracts well into their 30s, which is what an Alonzo Bergman exacta might look like, short-term gains notwithstanding. Lest we forget, the Yankees finished last season with a pretty good starting pitching situation with Gerrit Cole, Carlos Rodon, Clark Schmidt, and Luis Gil, all upright and often outstanding. That gives them a big advantage over almost every club, both on the field and in their winter pursuits. Sure, they can toss their hat in the Roki Sasaki sweepstakes, which would be a massive boon. But in terms of big-ticket items, a lefty bat and an elite corner guy would go a long way towards fulfilling the task that the Yankees did not want to undertake, replacing Soto in the aggregate. Then there are the Toronto Blue Jays, who are also trying to sign Soto. The Blue Jays will be going for a three-peat next year. Only come 2025, their own superstar will be the one in position to spurn their big-money offer. Now the Blue Jays need to worry about locking up Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Perhaps we'll learn more in the weeks and months ahead, but it was probably an easy no for Soto on Toronto when his would-be running mate in the lineup, the prodigious slugger Guerrero, was not signed beyond this year. For a guy who desired control and certainly that his future club was going to win for a decade plus to come, Soto could easily see a Guerrero-free future of 200 walks and third-place finishes in Toronto. And again, that feature is entitled Spurned Yankees and Soto Losers Forced to Pivot, written by Gabe Lackus of USA Today. That's all the time that we have for this edition of Sports Today. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Have a great evening. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.